Okay, today is March 30th, 2011. This is Joan Weber and Rosetta Graff from the Kinsey Library, and we're interviewing Jack Kersting in his home. Okay, Jack, can you give us your full name?
Jack Francis Kersting.
And, well, where do you currently reside?
10645 136 Road, rural Oberlin.
And when and where were you born?
I was born on a farm in rural Augusta, Kansas, in June 22nd, 1930.
And what were the names of your parents?
My dad's name was Henry Fred Kersting, and mother's name was Frances Willa. Her maiden name was Shockey.
Okay. And the names of your grandparents on both sides?
Grandpa Kersting was Henry Kersting, and Aunt Lena was, or Grandma Lena, died in childbirth, so I didn't know her. And then on mother's side, it was William Shockey and Francis Huff, maiden name.
And can you describe the makeup of your household that you grew up in?
We had had three brothers, and actually had five. One of them died before I was born. And we lived in rural Sedgwick County, right outside of Derby. We all went to Spring Creek School, a rural country school. And that school closed when my youngest brother was, I think, in the eighth grade. It was, I was still in high school, and I graduated from high school in 48. So he went to Derby then to school. And my older brother went to Wellington High School. And I had an aunt that taught down there, and at that time they thought Wellington could give a better education than could Derby. Derby was just a small school. And my brother between Fred, my oldest brother, and Herman, the next brother, and it was Herman who went to El Dorado and lived with aunt and uncle in El Dorado. And
so the brothers were Fred,
Herman, Jack, and Burton. And the oldest brother, I only ever heard the name of Sonny. That's all. And he died. He was born in 27 and died in 29. And I was born a year later.
What did he die of?
You know, I never asked the folks. I don't know, but my next brother Herman died in, he was in the Marines, and he was in the process of amphibian landing out in California, close to L.A., Camp Pendleton, and his amphibian craft overturned, and he died in the...
So that was in training?
He just out of training, and they were using him as an instructor. And he had just graduated the previous May, so he wasn't 19 yet. No, it could have been 19, but just 6 months out of high school. And
that's tragic.
And my mother never recovered. I know. I always thought that she just never, that's hard for anybody. Mm-hmm. So.
And your dad was a farmer?
No. Well, he started out farming, and then the depression caught up, and that's when we moved to rural Derby. Yeah, I was 2 years old. And from then, he worked for the WPA, and he worked at Boeing, and then after the war, he was a handyman around town and did all kinds of building work, of roofing and adding rooms and things like that.
You know what he did for the WPA?
He worked at a school in, I think it was Garden Plain. He worked at Lake Afton when they built Lake Afton. As a matter of fact, he took us three older boys with him one evening, and Fred and I, they told us to stay out of the water, but, you know, I think, you know, kids, we went in the water, and they had a trench in the water. We fell off into that trench, and Herman ran down and told the people that they're in the water, they're in the water. My dad couldn't swim, and he jumped in and pulled us out. So it was, after that, you couldn't take kids to the on your job. But he took us several places. We were also at a sand pit, and we were fishing, and a man caught a carp. They caught a carp in their sand pipe when they were pumping, and they gave that to us. And, they couldn't have given us anything better. We went home and showed Mother our fish.
And we heard from another interview that people ate carp. And at that time.
Yeah, we were, of course, folks warned us, now they're bony, so so we had to separate the bones.
Now, you were pretty young, so you probably don't remember a lot about the Depression, do you?
No, and you know, and as I look back on it, it was some of the best years of my life. I didn't know things were hard, and we went to, we got along, and I'm sure if my folks were here, they could tell you the hardships. Some of the exciting things were I was old enough to remember the merchants in Derby got somebody to come in and show movies every Thursday evening or so. And that highlight of the week, because folks always took us in to see the movies. And of course, they were all outside movies. And I remember one time the winds came up, and I remember the wind coming up, so I'm assuming we had to shut this whole thing down. But
when I described that, an outside movie, I mean, this isn't the drive-in.
No, they put up a big screen, and people just drove up around it in their cars like they do around these small-town football games. And the kids got out, and some of the parents, too, got out. They spread blankets out on the ground and sat there and watched the movie. The whole thing was, because he went from town to town to do that. That was the way he made his living. And I don't particularly remember any of the movies. I just remember the good times that we had going to the movies.
And then World War... Well, no, I missed the question here. Do you know what brought your people to... I guess maybe we're going to start with you because it's Edwards County we're in it.
Yeah.
Maybe let's hold that question because we're not quite there yet. What about World War II? Memories of that? I'm getting a little older then.
Yeah, I remember the Sunday the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and then I remember the stories that the newspaper covered, the Death March of Bataan. And we had a Kinsley man in that. And the paper would fill out or publish these stories. People, the reporter or writer, I can't remember the man's name that was in Europe that was a GI. He started the strip of GI.
Malden? M-A-U-D-L-I-N?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so those things I remember.
You remember any of the Victory Gardens, medal drives, or any of that sort of thing?
Oh my, yes. We were involved in that. We'd go out and take any medal we could find. And we had a little filling station there in Derby. And everything, she collected stuff. People brought it in. And rubber tires, anything. Grease, I think every family kept the grease.
Cause you mean like bacon fat?
Bacon fat, mainly bacon fat, but any grease from the cooking stove. used in making gunpowder.
Oh.
And I made an explosive anyway. I'm not sure how it was used. And the ration stamps, we had so many. Could get so many gallons of gas a month. And I remember my folks. We had to haul our drinking water from the old school, from the Spring Creek School, which was a mile and a quarter away. And we used milk cans. And we needed one milk can. And I remember Mother going into the office who controlled all this. And she begged them for a milk can. And they said, you're not producing milk. We can't give you one. And I remember Mother saying, you give me the milk can and I'll put milk in it. We were buying milk from a neighbor, but then shortly after that our dad got a cow. But we got the milk can. I don't know if they felt sorry for her or whatever, but anyway, she got the milk can.
Mm-hmm.
And we put in the back seat, on the floor of the back seat, we put 3 10-gallon cans and go up to the school and fill those 3-gallon cans, pump it by hand, and then that would last us till it was gone, and we'd go back again. But and that was we had to do that during the war too, so that took gas. And of course my dad worked at Boeing, and they carpooled a lot back then, and there was 2 neighbors that rode with my dad. And back then the roads were mud, we had no sand on them, and those ruts would get so deep. And I know one time we traveled that mile to get to a rock road, which is named Rock Road in Wichita now. And we wore out the clutch on the car going that mile through that mud. And we used to have snowstorms, blizzards, and the roads were just full of snow, and you couldn't go anywhere. And pretty soon, sometime a few days later, here come this cat with the snow plow on it. And of course, you know, a cat, I don't know, it takes an hour to go a mile, I don't know how long, but they were so slow. But boy, the neighbor man ran it, and he got out as quick as he could and opened the roads. And you could drive a car after he pushed up those drifts, you could drive a car through them, you couldn't see the car, you know, it'd be higher than the car. But it was a good life. I just had a great time.
Okay, so you got, you graduated from high school. I'm trying to think, that would have been about in 48?
48 at Wellington High School.
And then are we up to your service years about?
No, I went to Wichita U when fall of 48 till the spring of 51. And I don't remember the courses I was taking. I had visions of maybe I'd be a coach. I know I was taking some physical ed classes.
So you were an athlete in high school?
Well, not really.
You're being modest.
Well, I tried, but I was a country boy that went to a school where I knew nobody, nobody knew me, and the boys that were in that school grew up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd known each other from birth. So it was kind of hard to fit in. But I was shy, and so I never put myself forward. But I went out for football and played in one game and got knocked down. They took me out, and I never played again. So it's exciting. We followed the teams. We had everything. Last year, they put in baseball, and I went out for baseball and didn't make a team. But They were all, you could go out for any of them, football, basketball, track. Those were the main things. But,
you know. So you went to Wichita, you sort of on a, what, a liberal arts, and was that maybe that idea?
Yeah, and...
How were you paying for college?
Well, I worked through, always worked, worked for my uncle on the farm, and I know I was, as soon as I could drive a tractor, I was driving a tractor for him. And then through the summer when I was going to college, and on Saturdays, I worked with my dad. So we got $1 an hour, so I made $8 a day on Saturday, and that would carry me through on the next Saturday. And even I did buy a car in, it was a 41 Oldsmobile with an automatic transmission, and I was king of the walk. But eventually, you'll see, right? No, I was in the Navy, and that car, the front wheels on it got into problems and cost so much to fix it, and I took it around to the salvage yards, and I think I got $75 for it when I got rid of it. Because I was getting ready to go in the Navy.
So you were in college, and you make a decision to go in the Navy? Is that how it...
I did. The decision was forced on me. I was either going into Navy or I was going to be drafted. Mm-hmm. And the draft board gave me the time off to enlist in the Navy. And the Navy took me. I left with four of us local boys. Went to the Navy together.
And this is during the Korean.
This was in, right, it was during the Korean War. And I was a coward. I didn't want to go in the Army and get shot at, so I went in the Navy. Never was on board ship. 4 years in the Navy, never on board ship. But that was why the four of us decided we'd rather go in the Navy than in the Army.
So what did you do in the Navy while you were not
I was
on
in
ship?
Communications. And we... it was all... well, I was to get into that, you had to be approved by the FBI, and you had to give references of folks at home, and then they checked with those people, and I don't know what all they did, but I know to get into that phase of the Navy, you had to be approved by it was the FBI checked you out, and so we were on ADAC, we were checking the Russians' radio, trying to, we were spying on their communications, which they were doing to us at the same time. And we never, of course, they didn't tell us anything we find. It was all in Russian, but the typewriters, they trained a bunch of people, and Marilyn's brother was one of them that they trained. They could type the Russian signal, whatever it was, it had, and it was, I remember that the typewriters had Russian characters on them, and somebody, after they typed them, they were sent to someplace and deciphered, and I don't know if we ever found out any good information or not, but I'll tell you, we sure had a lot of antennas all over that island. We never missed a message, I don't think, but I have no idea if we did any good, but we got paid for it. So.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have missed it the 4 years. I didn't like it while I was there, a lot of it, but it was a great experience. And I still communicate with one of the fellows I knew in the Navy. One of them just died here this past year, so I didn't realize, but they're all getting old.
Yeah. You know?
But anyway, good. I had a good time. Got out, drove from Cheltenham, Maryland home. I bought a car from one of the boys there that wanted to sell it. It was a 48 Ford convertible. And drove it home, and the next fall enrolled in K-State.
And then you were on a GI Bill?
And I was on GI Bill, mm-hmm. yeah. And I was at K-State from 55 till the spring of 59, met Maryland in 58. And
she was attending K-State also?
Yeah. And we were married in 59. Mm-hmm. And we moved to the farm. Lived over at the Beeler Ranch, which is southwest of Kinsley.
Just a second. Before you go on to that, did you graduate from K-State?
Yes,
And what was your degree in?
I was in crops and soils.
So it was agriculture.
Agronomy. And
so it was good to meet somebody who knew something about farming?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I didn't care what she was interested in. I was interested in her. And then I went on and got my master's. And because Maryland had a year to go yet, and I was offered the position as a, I know I got paid from the school for my master's work, mm-hmm. which was in sorghum, and then I graduated the December after we were married, so December of 59.
So you were 1 year at K-State married?
So. Yeah, well...
About or whatever.
Yeah, we were married in June of 50.
No.
Well, it was a year, wasn't it? Yeah, it was a year. Mm-hmm. 59, and we came June of 59. I came here in December of 60. Because that a snow year. There was more snow. I'd never seen so much snow in this last year.
We came out here December of
59. Maybe 6 months.
On this one.
Yeah, but Caden was born in 60, and we were living with your folks when we came out here. So we came out here maybe December of 60, but it was... Okay, 59. Yeah. Okay.
But you were married here, here, and what was it, Zion?
Zion River. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Church. Mm-hmm. So that was your home church.
Yes.
And then went back up there to finish up the school. You had to finish school, and you finished your master's, and then came back.
Came out here, and Maryland's dad had told me before, he said, if you want to come out, you can farm this farm where we're living now. And so I said, we'll do that.
Was he ready to retire, or did he have other land?
He
had
other land, and I don't think Dad ever did retire. He just... kept going. He was quite a gentleman. It was unique. I think I saw the man mad once, and I don't know if it was me or who or what, but he was nothing really ruffled him. I'm sure he was concerned about things, but that was Harry Frochner, and he was a real gentleman. Anyway, so they planted Kermit, and that's Maryland's brother, planted the crop in the fall of 59, and we harvested it in the spring of 60, and that was our first crop. And then we used Harry's tractor and implements for
and what kind
years.
Of tractors and things were you using at this
John Deere.
Time?
He was John. Well, the combine was an international, and
tractor was open cabbed. And
oh yeah, yeah. We didn't have cabs on tractors till I bought a 4020, and it was a 68 tractor. It was built in 1968, and I think I probably bought it in 75 or 76. It was a dad's tractor with an 830 John Deere, and a hand clutch on it. of course, my uncle had John Deere's and hand clutch, but never had any that big. And so it was interesting. And
so, about how much land were you farming or helping?
There's 338 and 160 at that time, so 438 and 60. almost 500 acres.
And did the Froschner family, did they, you know, harvest together and that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah. For a number of years. Dad rented most of his ground that he planted, he rented, so we cut that first. And then we cut. He bought land and had his other boys, and they farmed that land. What's the ranch?
Matthew
Ranch up north of Ardell. And so they farmed that, and we farmed this, and Dad farmed his.
And the crop was wheat and...
Wheat and corn. Dad had some irrigation that he put in back in the 30s.
Oh, really?
Real early.
Real early, yeah.
And it wasn't much, but to use it for insulage. And they planted sorghum on it, and then they planted corn.
But most of it was dry land in the 50s and 60s?
Nearly everything was dry land. Everything was, except for that. Maybe 30 acres that Dad had that was irrigated by trench irrigation. Whatever needed done was done, whether it was 110 degrees and the sun was shining, the wind was blowing, or whether it was cold. Whatever was done, it was done. And I only used Dad's tractor, so... You know, we had to work around each other, but very generous. He let us use it for a number of years till we bought one. And then later on, and several years later, somebody wanted to sell the 151 International, is what we used, what Dad had. Somebody had another one, so I bought it. So we had two combines there for a while. Then I went on to Massey's and wound up with John Deere.
And what was your yields in the 60s? I know it's a range, yeah, depending on the year.
I'm going to guess somewhere in the 30s. Only one year did I remember a real crop failure, and that I can't tell you the year, but our wheat made 3 or 4. As a matter of fact, I was ready to give up on it. Dad said, no, you go ahead and cut it. And I know the Oakley Co-op talked about the wheat was so low, so short, the combines went down and they would get cow manure in their wheat when they hauled into the elevator. So it was a bad year. But I can't place the year. I know when we were married, I worked for FSA now, but it was agriculture there in Kinsley, for the government, measuring crops. We had to measure, then go out with a chain, the measurement of a chain, and count off, measure the chains on how big the fields were. And you were very limited in the amount of wheat you could plant. And if you got over it, there was a give or take, but if you got much over it, they really landed hard on you.
And why was this?
Well, it was a law.
There was too much wheat and they didn't want to have too much, or?
No, every farmer was allowed to plant so many acres. And regardless of what it made, you could plant that many acres. Of course, you didn't have to plant that many, but you couldn't plant over that. And we'd have to go out in a muddle. I remember up on Joe Hines' place there right west of Ardell. He had big old mud holes. And we'd have to go out and measure out those mud holes so he wouldn't get counted as wheat planted. So we did that wherever they were, but I just remember Joe Hines' place up there.
But you don't know why you were limited.
Well, it was just the government law. Just agriculture, the Department of Agriculture. But it's always been, you've only got so many acres that you can plant. And in these later years, it's been different. But boy, for the biggest share of our farming, we were limited. We could plant so many acres of wheat, and their record showed that we planted, I'll just say, 160 acres of wheat. That was what your wheat allotment was based on for years and years and years. If you planted, I know one year I planted some oats bad because that year they used that oats as part of my, and oats is not a crop that you want to raise in this country. But I had planted for whatever reason, and I had an oats base for years, and it was worthless as far as financial.
And if you bought more land, it would depend on what that had been had in wheat previously.
The history of that land went with it. We bought this quarter of ground right south of us from Marilyn's uncle. And I don't remember what the base was on it, but it had a base of wheat on it, and that's what we could find. Mm-hmm. But once you got that farm, we could combine the two mm-hmm. farms, or take that acreage and combine it with our farm. Then we had that much more acreage. We had a choice of where to plant, mm-hmm. but you still couldn't plant any more than that.
So you weren't irrigating in the 60s. How about fertilizer or pesticides? Were you using those?
Yeah, I don't remember using very little pesticide, but yeah, we used fertilizer, mainly dry nitrogen and phosphate. And this country at that time didn't need any potassium and didn't really need, when I was going to college, anything west of 81, all the people talk about was nitrogen. It had everything else, but over the years we used it up, so now we have to add to it.
Okay, let's see. Now, did you do animals at all?
We had cattle. We had a cow herd, and we would buy calves in the fall and feed them through, and sometimes sell them in the spring, sometimes carry them the later summer. And we did a couple times, but we had several pens of cattle we put in the Ford County feed yard. And just 2 years we planted. One time it was steers, and one time a bunch of heifers. And came out even or ahead, whatever it was. We didn't lose money on them, so that was the main thing. But at that time, we didn't have much of a cow herd either. We only had a few.
About how many head are you?
Well, we usually would try to have 100 to 125 calves that we bought in the fall. And one time we had about 40 cows. And then
you were raising the insulage or whatever to feed them through the winter.
Yeah, we raised all of our feed. And then we got out of the cattle business in 86, 85 or 86, when I went to work at Crustbuster. But in the late 60s and early 70s, we were in a hog program with Purina. And we raised hogs for 5 or 6 years, and I remember selling hogs for $13 a hundred. And just a few years after that, I remember they went to $55 a hundred.
And how many hogs would you have when you were raising those?
We probably had, well, we had 20 sows, and 2 litters a year, you know, we'd probably get. And we didn't have real good luck with the raising the baby pigs. But we also bought, would buy baby pigs or feeder pigs. And I know I used to haul from here to Great Bend, because Great Bend you could sell them grading yields. And I'd take them to Great Bend the same time that Dodge was having their hog sale. And invariably we beat Dodge by $1.50 to $2.50 a hundred. So we take 10 hogs, which average about 240 pounds a piece, and to Great Bend. So we always thought it paid. And gas is 24 cents a gallon.
It makes a difference.
I used to take 55 gallon drums, take two of those and put them, range them on a rack above the hogs. Then I'd fill them up in Great Bend for 24 cents a gallon.
And that Pawnee Rock?
Yeah, Pawnee Rock.
Pawnee Rock had the cheapest gas.
Yeah, lots of times we'd fill them right there in Pawnee Rock along the highway. They had a little station. So we took advantage. But when they got out of the hogs in 73 or 4, somewhere along in there, and never raised two. We had a few sheep at one time, and my daughter had horses while she was here, and that herd grew, and then finally she went her way, and so we had to get rid of the horses. We didn't have feed, and horses are, as people are finding out now, they're not a money maker.
No.
So we got out of the horse business.
And you were having your children in the 60s. Looks like
right.
You had four children. Did you have a milk cow, or did you not go that route?
When we were living at the Beater Ranch, my dad quit. He moved to town. He and mother moved to town in 62, and he gave us his milk cows, which was three or four, maybe five. So we bought a electric milker, and we milked cows and raised eggs, chicken and eggs, and peddled them around Kinsley. And so one time I sat down to figure out how much we were making on cream and milk, and we had our own, so I didn't count that, but we were making about 10 cents a day. And so we got out of the milking business. But we had to. My folks lived in Derby, and we'd go down and see them for two or three days. Then we had to have somebody milk the cows. It always fell on Dad and Marilyn's brother. So that was part of it. But the main thing was we were tied down twice a day and
weren't making
anything. I didn't mind milking. It was just the fact that there wasn't any money involved with it. So we quit that, and then we moved over here. We had chickens for a while, but we got out of that too. And now we don't have anything but dogs. And we rent our pasture. That's why we don't use it.
Okay, and your children went to school in Offerley, or?
Yeah, they all went to school in Offerley, and then, of course, to Kinsley. Mm-hmm. Kaylin started school the year, she started school in 66, and it was either 66 or 67 when they consolidated. And, but the grade school was left in Offerley. So all of our children went to grade school in Offerley.
Maybe I said in Maryland during the 60s you were just a housewife.
Yes.
With four children, that would
yes.
be enough, uh-huh. I think. And we were sort of interested in the consolidation process. Do you remember how that went?
Well, it didn't bother the kids any. I was sure of that. That it was just one of those things that they just accepted. But to this day, there are people in this community that are unhappy. And one of the main things is that the schools very seldom talk about Kinsley Oferly. And the people in Oferly area like to be acknowledged that their school is now in Kinsley. Similar to the school just east of Kinsley, there was friction here, there is friction there, you know, and of course, back years ago, they played all these schools, Windhorse, Spiral, they played, and there was pride in their own school and animosity towards your opponent. and part of that still exists, but for the most part, people.
Do you think it helped because they left the elementary school in Oferly?
That made a world of difference and people. At least they still had their school. Every once in a while, the high school would play their ball games in Oferly. So this all helped. Of course, I was an outsider, really, and it didn't bother me. And I don't think.
No, it didn't bother me that much either. You know, my kids were happy that they were in the system and they accepted it. I did too. It's just like these little schools now, they can't make it on their own. But we had the 50-50 league, which was 53 schools up on the north 50 highway and the three down here. And we had Spearville and Windhorst and Oferly. And up north was Burdett, Roselle, and Hanston. And so, you know, we had a lot of close people we could play with our sports and things.
Before the consolidation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The people playing sports and that close together, they knew, the kids knew the kids. You know, it wasn't like people from Wichita coming out here going into school or myself going to Wellington. The kids knew each other. And so I always said that the kids never had any problems, but the adults sure did.
Were you on the school board, or am I remembering something?
Yeah, I was on the school board.
What years were?
Well, I think I went on in 67, and I was on for 8 years.
So you were on right after the consolidation?
Yeah, I went on right after. And, you know, as I remember, there was talk about give Oferly credit for, you know, Kinsley Oferly, let's do it all Kinsley Oferly. But people accepted it. We had to accept. When I came out here in Oferly, there were two grocery stores, there was a lumber yard, there was a drug store. And one fella put in a pet store. There were two filling stations. What was in the beauty shop? Well, that was a locker. Was there a locker in there? Where there's a beauty shop now. That was a hardware store. There was a cafe and a hardware store.
There was a barber, but I think that's before your time.
Yeah, that's right.
It
was a barber.
And then there was
the
pool hall.
A pool hall. Liquor store.
So this is in 1960, all of these, this was the Oferly community.
Right around 60. Harry Brown put in the liquor store, and whenever that was legal, he put that in. But that was originally the pool hall, and that was there when I moved out here.
The barber shop. You see that? I mean, that part was probably gone when you took out.
Anyway, but we lived over to Kinsley, close to Kinsley, and we did all our business in Kinsley. And I never really got acquainted with Oferly, because I would go into Oferly to the co-op and the lumber yard, and then I lived over south of Kinsley. So we just
maybe you should tell us exactly where Where was this, south of Kinsley, that you were living?
Okay, Beeler Ranch was, it's 2 miles west of Kinsley, and let's see, it's a half a mile, 1 mile, two. It's 3 miles south. 2 miles west and 3 miles south. It's on the west side of the road.
And you were there until what year?
50. We moved here May 1st, 1965. Okay. So we've lived there for five years.
Mm-hmm. And then when you came here, did you start to use the Oakley Co-op in that? Or?
Well, I always used the Oakley Co-op because we hauled our crops there. And Dad was on the board then, which didn't make any difference to me. I didn't know that much about co-ops then. But that's what we did our crops, bought our fuel, and everything was that hopefully. That I knew, but I didn't have anything to do with the other businesses, the drugstore.
So even when you were living south of Kinsley, the crops came here, or did they go to Kinsley?
No, they went to Oakley.
All the crops came to Oakley, but your other business you were doing in Kinsley for that first time.
You know, our groceries.
We
just lived in the house.
Okay.
Belonged to John Frocher, and we just rented the house.
I see. Okay.
And we did our doctoring, drugstore, medical, or grocery store. Was all done in Kinsley.
Okay. Because it's closer.
Because that's where we live. And I didn't have connections with Oakley. Marilyn did, but my connections were in Kinsley. And that I knew more people in Kinsley probably than I did in Oakley because I was just involved there.
Mm-hmm. Are you chilly?
Oh, I'm fine.
Are you okay?
Well, whatever you need.
To put on that little heater makes noise.
Okay, in church now, you were attending what church?
Zion Lutheran.
Okay, so you still came over here to church.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And what was the church like in the 60s?
Oh, full. It was full of everybody. The Kurtz family had 5 children, and your family had 4, and Dora's family had 5.
Lots
Carl
of
had 4.
Sunday school.
That was just in our family, and then there were all the Weisses just Molitors. It was, boy, I don't know, 180 to 100 people probably every Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Now we're down to 40.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a full-time minister, and there was never a school. Was Zion there earlier? Or there
years
was
ago, there
years
was.
Ago.
Mm-hmm.
Before my time.
Mm-hmm. Did the church provide some of your social life?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have meetings there at the church.
Sunday school picnics.
And AAL meeting, which is an insurance company, but they sponsored it, and we would have the meeting and have a meal, have refreshments at times, and I don't know much about Wasser League, but the young people had the Wasser League, which was their, there was a lot of activity in that church at that time. Weddings, funerals.
And services week. Just on Sunday, or did you have midweek?
Just Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. You were having children in the 60s. Hospital? Kinsley Hospital? Or where were your children born?
They were born in Dodge.
Oh, in Dodge.
The Trinity Hospital.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. When we were living in Manhattan, Marilyn was pregnant with Kaylin, and they had a doctor up there that, first of all, he told her she wasn't pregnant, and that broke her heart, and then she found out she was. And Dr. Baum was your mother's doctor? How did Dr. Baum get involved?
I'm almost thinking that the doctor in Manhattan may have recommended her.
Anyway, she started going to Dr. Baum, and he was such a delightful person to know, just as a person, and then as a doctor. So that's where her faith was, in her baby doctor. I went most of my time. I went to Dr. Atwood, Dr. Snowden occasionally, but I was in the hospital once in Kinsley, and other than that, but most of my health was taken care of in Kinsley.
And the kids were after they were born.
Yeah, Dr. Bond.
But
we also doctored in Kinsley. Kaden was operated on by all three doctors, Kim, Atwood, and Snowden.
Yeah, I guess we did take our kids a lot of times to the Kinsley doctors. I think it was mostly my obstetrics. And
the baby, when they were babies, take them up to get them checked out.
What else do we want to know, Miss Rosetta, about Ophelie?
You said the Matthew Ranch. Is that like Carol Matthew? That was her dad,
her father-in-law.
Father.
Yeah. Carol Matthew married Tom Matthew.
Yeah. Okay. Father. And they had the cattle.
He had Hereford cattle.
Hereford cattle. Okay. We have pictures of the Hereford cattle, but I wanted to make sure it was the same.
Yeah, that's the same.
Were your kids involved in 4-H or anything, or in the farming?
Oh, yeah. They were big 4-H all their life from the time.
What projects did their animals?
Cooking. Yeah, it was kind of funny. I thought, kids, let's get into cattle. So we bought steers and we picked steers out of the ones, and that was quite an ordeal to try to teach a 700-800-pound steer to lead. But they did a good job I had never done it. I didn't know what I remember that probably embarrassed my kids to death. We needed halters, so I went down, bought halters. Well, I bought horse halters, and you don't put horse halters on cattle. But we went to the 4-H show with them, and the judge in there said you ought to get cattle halters for them. So anyway, but they did that. They went gardening, flowers, cooking, sewing.
Anything, any of them in the art?
Horses. Yeah, I don't remember any art. Caitlin was in horses. Well, just Caitlin. Was Laura? I don't think so. Just Caitlin.
Were either of you involved in 4-H as far as leading?
We both were.
And what did you?
I was gardening.
Gardening?
I think I was cooking, sewing, probably. That's long time ago.
Yeah. We had a real good sewing. Jerry Crumrock. She was excellent. But we had a lot of good. Wagners were involved, and Mrs. Katz was involved, Mrs. Harold Katz.
So it was a pretty big club.
Yeah, they had.
Mm-hmm. What was your club?
Trenton Workers. Does that name still exist today?
I think it still works.
I think so.
And were there agricultural classes at the school? Do you remember?
Was in Kinsley, but there wasn't where I went to school. But Kinsley, and we were trying to think of the man's name. It was Elton. Lived southeast of Kinsley. Was a teacher there in. I substituted a little bit and knew Keith Kirby, got acquainted with Keith Kirby, and he talked to the superintendent, and they asked me to teach ag, because that was actually what I started with at K-State. Mm-hmm. And they needed substitute teachers, and I told the superintendent, I said, I do not have a teaching certificate. He says, let me take care of that. And that was the end of it. So I substituted there in the 60s several years.
Was this to supplement the farming income? Something to do in the winter?
Yeah. we weren't rich, and we got along, but
in fact, I think when you did your measuring for the ag services, am I correct, when you got $2 an hour, and something, that was good money.
Something like that, yeah. It was in the
$2. No, what years were that? Was that?
Well, it had to be, because I was still living over there, so it had to be before 1965. Probably 60. Kalen, I remember taking Kalen out and getting her to drive the pickup, and she couldn't do it. I said, Kalen, just stay in the middle of the road. She didn't wander
away. How old was she?
She couldn't have been over 3 or 4. She didn't know any more about it. But anyway, but I thought, well, if I take her and she can drive, I don't have to walk back. Because we had to get out and walk. Mm-hmm. We had this chain thing that was 16 and a half feet long, which measured an acre in a half a mile. So we'd measure out, and it was...
So you just kept moving that chain. That was 16 and a half feet.
We had little pegs. We'd run that, stick the peg in the ground and pull the chain through that peg.
That doesn't sound like a fun job.
Well, it wasn't much fun, but it paid.
Yeah, $2 an hour.
That was... It,
and it was pretty good wages.
Yeah, it was.
Mm-hmm. So what changes did when did Overly start to lose its businesses? And
well, the fire took out the drugstore.
Well, you know what year that was?
Well, it had to be in the 60s. And then...
The proprietors were older and retired, and nobody took over at that point.
Where the restaurant is now used to be a hardware store.
Oliphant's
Hardware, and they sold out. I remember them selling out. We got here then the grocery store in the south end was
Baskill. That would be
Coates. I can't tell you for sure. I know that he died and she ran. I went in there. I was only in there. I only remember one time that I was in there and she was running it. And then they sold out. She must have died, and they sold the, had the auction, sold that out. The Oakley Co-op sold their, that was, they did, they sold that in the 80s, their lumber yard, to Victor and Don Strong, Victor Kerr, and then in time they moved to Kinsley, took everything to Kinsley, bought the Ace Hardware over there, moved everything over there. Abner Oakley store closed. We used that for several years for a consignment auction, and then after Abner quit, Jerry.
Tell me what was in there. What was it?
It was a grocery store with Jerry.
Oh,
Kevin Conrad. Jerry Conrad.
Okay.
Ran the grocery store there for. For a while, and then we sold him out, and then we rented the building from Abner.
When did the grocery store leave? What year?
Well, I was started auctioneering in 77, so it had to be in the 80s that they closed. Mm-hmm. And that was the last grocery store. And then I used it, then Abner died, and the family, we sold everything out of the basement for the Oakley family, and sold a building, and a fellow in Dodge bought the building, and he had an antique store in there for a while. Then he sold a building to the fellow that now I can't think of his name now.
He married Smith.
Mrs. Smith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The names are just getting away.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Anyway.
So the declining is sort of start is in the 70s, in early 80s is when by the mid 80s you're pretty much don't have businesses left. Except for the bank and the co-op.
Wonderful. The bank. Charles Beck had a real nice. And before that, A&V Ann and Vincent Riggs had a real good restaurant and wonderful pies. And Charles carried on that. He had good food and good pies. And he moved, I guess, is why, isn't it, Charles?
Well, they sold it to Larry Lee.
Yeah, Larry Lee.
Rachel Lee. And she ran it for a while. It was closed off and on. And then the people that have it now, the Mexican family came from California and bought it. And nice people. We've eaten there a few times. We don't eat out much, but we've eaten there a few times. And she buys our tomatoes and melons that we have, and just real wonderful people. Hopefully, lucky to have people like that in their community.
And you lucky to have a cafe.
Yeah. You had four children, and what are they doing now? Did any of them stay in the community?
Well, Kaylin went from here to college and wound up as a bank examiner. And then she met Jeff Hahn at the Hanston Bank, and they got married. So, and she ran it. She still examined for a while, and then finally it didn't work. So she quit that. And now she's postmaster at Roselle. Kenton, of course, went to college with a teacher, did play. He loved acting, and so he was the teacher in the Parsons Junior College, Labette Junior College, and then he went to Bartlesville, opened an antique store, and one time he was driving home from Tulsa listening to the radio, and they had the ad for people to teach in China. And Kent said, I just said, well, I can do that. And that was in June, I think, or early the next January, he was in China. And he was there for 5 years, and then he moved to Laos, and he's been there 5 years. And then Cheryl went to college. She started out to help people that were financially, advising people that were in financial trouble. Then she married Bob Annan, and she worked around Topeka, Hills Brothers Dog Food, and then they moved to Sabetha, and Bob has got a good job up there with Extrutech Corporation. And Cheryl has worked for a dentist, for a chiropractor, for a veterinarian, and for about 5 years she had her own little gift shop, and that was in Fairview, which is 5 miles from Sabetha. And Laura went to Dodge JUCO, and then she got married, and she was a paraprofessional in Lewis and also at Hanston, and then they separated, and she's now living in Jetmore working for the Hodgman County District Court.
So half of your children have stayed in rural western Kansas.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
they're about 50%.
All girls are within half hour driving distance.
Plus or minus. kind of unusual for this time of year.
Yeah.
But
we need to stop so you can get a drink here. We can
like
do that.
Coffee?
Did you make some coffee?
Yeah.
Would you like
Are we running out of time, or?
Oh, no, we're fine. Okay, Jack, so what you been doing with your life since the 1970s, say? What's some of the highlights?
We started auctioneering in 1977, and our first auction was in Kinsley with, it was, I want to say Arsenic and Overlays.
Alice Stetson is her name, but I don't know what their shop name was.
It was an antique store right across from the theater, and she wanted to sell out. Stanley Young and I were partners at that time, and then later through the years, well, we separated.
How did you get into auctioneering?
I, up at Dodge City JUCO, read in the paper, they were offering a course in auctioneering. And it was so difficult for me to think going to auction school and spending 2 weeks away from home when I, you know, we had the chores. So, excuse me. So I just took the course up there, and there were seven or eight of us in the course, and I was the only one that continued it, but enjoyed it and enjoy the work.
And you're still farming at the same time?
Yeah,
this is on
we
the
were farming. It was a part-time job, obviously. And the first few years, I think the first year, Stan and I had something like 15 auctions. And then as, well, Larry Carr, you know, he's got his big place where people can take stuff and he can hold it for them. Same way as Scott Brown is. So it was pretty hard to compete against those two and Kirk's out west. All of them started years before we started. Scott Brown goes back in, I think it's, we're back in the 30s. Kirk started in right after the war, I think he told me in 48. And Larry Carr started about 63.
Now, so, what do you learn in auction school?
Well, you learn your chant.
Maybe we can get you to do some of that.
my chant isn't something like the, like, you remember the auctioneer song? It's nothing like that. But anyway, we spend a lot of time and counting by 2.5, by 5, by 10, by 2, upwards, and then go back. And went through some Peter Piper picked a peck of pickle pepper peppers, you know, this type of thing to make you try to keep your
really? Can you sell me that?
Well, I can try.
Okay, let's hear a little of you chant.
All right, but we have a little Scotty dog here who will start that at 5. We get $5, we get 5, 5, we get 5, thank you, and now 7.5. 5, now 7.5, and $10, we get 10, 10, 10, 12.5, 12.5. Don't lose it for this price, 12.5. That's your 15. Want to get 15, 15, 15, 15. You can just keep going. I'll stop you when it's high. She went. That's good. And 70. Yes, now 20. 20. Oh, come on now. It's just money, and you'll enjoy this thing forever.
It's
oh, it's
bank.
A bank, too.
A bank.
Look there.
It's a bank.
It might have some money in it. Ah, thank you. 20. Now 22. 22. Are you sure you're done? 22. 22. I've sold it $20 to number 17.
Very good. Well, that was fun. I like that.
That's what we did up there in school. He'd bring things to school, and he'd have us price them. He says, "What are? Tell me what this is worth." So, and we never knew. If we were lucky, we got within a couple dollars. But I remember one time he brought some soapstone, sculpture, and I thought I was pretty smart that we were in there. But what he said it was worth and what I said it was worth, we didn't agree by far. But you never know at an auction. You never know because you don't know how bad this person wants it. You hope there's two there that want it, at least two that want it. If not, well, you know, we sold a lot of things for a dollar. And
sometimes boxes of things.
Yeah, boxes of things for a dollar. And now I question if they were worth that. But I, thank you, people. Thank you. When we get into state, we want to sell everything, particularly if we've moved it from the home, because we don't want to move back. And if we don't sell it, it still belongs in that estate. So I lots of times will just bid 50 cents on something. It's sold, it's mine, the estate's out of it. So anyway, we've been doing auctions now for, well, that's 34 years, going on 34. It was in the, it was probably in June that we had that first sale. I can't exactly put that, but anyway.
Now, does Marilyn help you with the auction?
Oh, Marilyn is a wonderful, she keeps the business going. She's the clerk, and she does the when the bills are all paid, and she does the money, takes care of the money. Our daughter Laura helps a lot as a cashier, and Caitlin does too. And
when we first started, they all.
Oh yeah, we had all of. I remember when Laura was 6 or 7 years old. We'd been to Larry Carr's auctions a lot. Larry's always saying cheap, cheap, cheap when somebody went, when he thought something. Well, here's little old Laura strutting around and talking to people there in Kinsley. We had something up. Lewis boys were there, and Laura says, cheap, cheap, cheap. And the Lewis boy just busted out laughing. They were great people. I really enjoyed Bert and Buck Lewis. They were, I bought a lot of stuff from them and sold them a lot of stuff. We always wanted to see them come because it may be just a quarter, but we got rid of it. And they,
now, for our tape, the Lewis, why were they buying and selling?
Lewis boys were, Mrs. Snowblum called them the Flegel brothers. Because those boys, they bought anything, and they'd take it out to the ranch, and people would go out there and look for stuff, and they told me lots of times they'd put something back under a bench so it looked like it'd been there for years, and people would come out, oh, look what we found. They'd bring it over. And Bert told me one time, he says, we sold a horse, a blind horse one time, and we told the guy buying it, he doesn't look too good. But this was the Lewis boys. You should have been interviewing them, you know.
So they had sort of a flea market? And
oh, no, they would just had a ranch.
Just
out
a
there.
Ranch
they
and
had
a ranch.
A bunch
people,
of sheds.
But
yeah,
people
bunch of
knew
sheds.
That they had things that they would sell. So they would stop by the Lewis's and see if they could find something to buy.
But I bought truck tires from them. Anything that they could make money on, they bought. And then we had their sale after the boys died. Buck's boy, he runs the cattle.
Dan.
Yeah. He contacted us, and so we had their sale one, I think it was in January. I know I had some barrels around with heat, wood fires to warm up, but it was beautiful day for that time of the year, and we had quite a crowd. Of course, everybody knew Lewis. It was for miles around, and they all came.
And I think the sun was shining,
oh,
and no
yeah.
wind, and you know, one of those January days that you couldn't ask for anything better, you know.
So that was probably, I don't say that was the most memorable auction, but right now it's the only one I think of, and it was such a, I felt close to the Lewis boys, and I felt it was an honor that they asked us to have it. So, but we have another auctioneer that helps us, and we have another boy in Dodge City that is a ring man, helps us. He knows a lot about antiques. And
what's a ring man?
That's somebody that holds something up while you're selling it, and they also take bids. But you have the auctioneer, then you got the ring man, or man, whatever it is, And it's their job just to pick up stuff and be ready to go when something's sold. Then you have the clerk who records everything, and then the cashier who takes the money. And usually within a week, the owner has it, and we have their money. We've always gone, I know it's not recommended by legal people, but we've always told people that once you have us have the sale, we take everything, and we take the responsibility. If we get a hot check, we will take care of it. Well, legal people tell you can't do that, but fortunately we haven't had any. Oh, I think we maybe a couple of them, but over the years of it, we haven't lost $50 altogether. Most people, the main problem is people will leave before their last bill gets in, and then so we have to, usually after every auction, we'll have about three to five, maybe once in a while more, but people didn't pay, so we get their name and address, we get their phone numbers, and I write them a letter of you owe us this much. If you bought this item, and I put the little ticket in there, and if they've bought it, they'll pay for it, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
But we've had people say, I didn't buy it. Mm-hmm. And
we just take their word for it. There's mistakes made when you're clerking.
Mm-hmm. You know, 24, 54, 64, for instance. 54, well, maybe she thought I said 64.
Mm-hmm.
And she's always stopping me and saying, whose number? I forget to give her a number. Who? What number is that? So, and then, two, we get to where we think we know the number, a person's number, and we may not actually write at that time. So, oh, that's 33, Marilyn. And they don't say anything. And then we find out that 33 didn't buy it. So, there are little things like that happen all the time.
So you really have to be really alert for that long time.
We've had them as long as eight or over hours.
Well, Bill Froschner's we had started probably at 10 o'clock in the morning at Randall after dark, and that was in the spring. So, but probably should have had a two-day sale, but golly, when you have a two-day sale, people want to know what you're going to sell the first day, mm-hmm. and the second day. And if you're going to have a two-day sale, you better split it so mm-hmm. they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we've ever had a two-day sale. We always managed to get ours done. We can sell about 90 items in an hour. So we have a five-hour sale. We got 450, 500 items. And try to get done, start at 10, get done hopefully around 3 in the afternoon. Sometimes a little longer, and sometimes a little less. Depends on the amount of items you have. That's probably the biggest thing. Well, in the 80s, I went to work at Crust Buster and worked there till. Yeah, I know there was a time in there that I drew unemployment because they laid everybody off. But then they went back, and when I went back the second time, the grass program was just going in, and we built zillions of grass drills. They had everything in the building. They were ready to shut down when the government authorized this grass drill, and they were ready to go with the grass drill.
What did you do for them?
I worked in, they called it Plant 3, and that we made the parts, just made the parts. They shipped them over across the street where they welded them together and put the machine together. But we took the raw material and made the parts, whether it needed holes punched in it or bent or whatever it needed, that sort.
And where is Crust Busters located?
In Spearville. And then I retired there in 92 when I was 62.
And you were still farming while you were in
Prescott? Yeah, we were farming. But we got, that's one reason we got rid of the cattle. And also the irrigated ground. Bud Horning rented it for several years, and then the Wetzel boys rented it. So we did.
I guess I never asked you, did you ever irrigate any more of your ground other than that 30 acres?
Yeah, we irrigated 110 acres on the west side.
What? When did you do that? About?
Well, 76. I think he drilled that well in 76. And
also irrigated down south, too.
Yeah, we had a quarter down south that we had bought from Marilyn's uncle. And then we sold that. But we put a circle on that one down there.
Have you seen changes in the water? Did you have you had to re-drill wells or anything? Or?
Well, I did, but the wasn't the water's fault. It the casing, not the casing, the pipe the water comes up in, you pump it up in, got a hole in it, and it was about 100 feet down, and that hole hitting against the casing just bore a big hole. And when it did that, the fill sand around the well came down into the well and filled the two lengths of our circle up with sand. So we drilled another well right beside it. But
the water table stayed about the same.
Yeah, the water table has remained the same remarkably in this area. We're in Dakota sandstone here, and measured every year, and I don't think there's been a foot difference in all the years that we've irrigated. We did irrigate about 80 acres right north of the house, but that well did not hold up to what they said it started, and we had alfalfa out there one year, and you just couldn't water the alfalfa. And then the water people said, you're irrigating more ground than you're entitled to. And then the government came out with a program to buy out your wells.
You
basically. Yeah. So we went in with that. Kept us out of trouble with the state. And we weren't getting enough water really to raise a crop. And so that irrigation's abandoned. And but the one over west, the Wetzel boys put a circle on, and they're irrigating 85 acres now. And okay, where do we go?
Well,
okay, probably the highlight happened last year. We paid off our land loans, and so the first time in 45 years or whatever, we've been married 50, we probably mid 70s that we got in trouble and had to mortgage some land, and we finally got out of it in 2010 and had a big burning of the you bet. I did a substitute teach since in the last 10-12 years, and learned a lot about poor teachers. I had a little kindergarten girl one time. They were sitting around. I said, okay, we can all get up on our chairs now and we'll go back to work. The little girl sat there on the floor and says, make me. A kindergarten girl. So Jack told Marilyn when he came home, he says, if they ever call me again, tell them I'm busy, I'm dead, anything. Not going back into that class.
Not to that kindergarten.
Anyway.
I just thought kindergarten, you know, he had to have had a wonderful day, because kindergarten kids look up to mm-hmm. the teachers.
Especially a man.
Boy, he says, if they ever call me again, tell them I died, tell them I'm busy, tell them I won't go back.
Well, Well, you're a transplant into Edwards County, coming here as a grown man. How do you think your life has been affected living here?
Oh, I want to say loved every minute of it. I suppose there were minutes that maybe I didn't love, but all in all, it's a great place to live. Actually, we've got all the amenities of life we need are within area, you know, within driving range of it if we need that. It's nothing like. I've been reading a book on the history of Kansas. They talk about how long it just takes them to get to Kansas City to Medicine Lodge and things like that. 5 days or something. Well, you know, we're just. And I'll be going to Wichita tomorrow through the VA hospital, but everything else is just, you know, it's here, and people are just been good to us, been good to me, my family.
Tell them when you first came out, what you felt, how you felt. This area varied from Sedgwick County.
Well, we were in Sedgwick County, and my uncle's farm. There were creeks. There were creeks, and fields were determined by the creeks, you know, for the most part. And I got out here, and another thing in Wichita, we lived right south of McConnell Air Force Base, and those big bombers used to come and just circle our house. They'd always come out, and when they circled, you didn't talk. You couldn't do anything. I got out here. Jeez, no airplanes. If there were, they were so high that it didn't bother you. And fields were quarters. You know, there wasn't very few fields in this area are cut up.
I was thinking more of the honesty of the people. Where you said you couldn't, you could see a tractor out in the field here, and back there, that was really taking a chance.
Anything around Wichita was. That was out in the field or not tied down, even in your yard, run the risk of it. And out here, geez, if the field at nighttime, come get me, Marilyn. We didn't have cell phones then. So Marilyn, I say, well, come over and get me about dark. So we'd shut things off and leave it there, and it'd still be there in the morning. So, yeah, we... the people, the people as a whole were different than around Wichita, because he felt like nearly everybody out here you could trust. Back there, you could, but...
People still leave things out in the field, don't they? I think they do when I drive around, and I'm always amazed, you know.
We had a man lived up at St. Mary's, just north of St. Mary's Church, had his tractor stolen in the last 4 or 5 years, maybe more than that, because time gets away from me. But and then you hear and read about people that, well, look at the aluminum and copper that's being stolen now, and they're ripping off bleachers. And I can't understand the people they sell this to. If I go in there with a truckload of bleachers, you know. So anyway, we're living in a whole different world now. Just, I worry about my grandkids.
How many grandkids do you have?
We've got 10. Mm-hmm. And everywhere from 4 years old up to we've got great grandchildren. Our oldest daughter adopted 3 children, her and her husband, and they, 2 of them have got children, and so we've
got a lot to keep track of.
Well, that's Marilyn's job. I
can keep track of the grandchildren, but the greats, I don't know their birthdays.
What do you see for the future of Edwards County?
Well, I said there's less people and less businesses. There'd be bigger farms, there'd be more consolidations, and maybe even county consolidations. If and when we ever get out of this recession or depression or whatever they want to call it, I think things will stabilize. But until then, just go down the streets of Kinsley and see how many businesses have disappeared in the last 10 years.
What's the difference in the farming then and now and what you see in the future of?
Well, farming, we're probably the smallest farmer in the area, really. And we're not, I'm not, if you read the farm magazines, they've got this satellite GPS, I think is what they call it. I'm not into that. We have so many technical things like if they know, they can tell spots in your field where you need more nitrogen than others. Well, using a GPS, they can adjust automatically. This will adjust, and everything is just, a son-in-law's got this GPS, and they just set it, and they don't have to drive the tractor. They do, but, well, there's always somebody in the cab. But once you get started on that whatever, that degree, whatever they call it, it goes. And then you get to the end of the row, of course, you've got to turn around. And I don't know how that works. They may even have that to where it ends. But he told me one year, first year they got it, they used it. And then the next year, they were going to put on fertilizer. It was for corn. They were planting corn. Next year, we were going to put on fertilizer. And it went right back to the exact spots and went right down the road, just like they've been before. So, and we're going to see more of that, I think. We're going to see a lot of this very fine adjustments of in the fields, where you need something or don't, where we are getting, which is quite a concern. I don't know that we've got it here, but this kochia is getting resistant to, Roundup, those type of things. And I just saw in the magazine, they showed a picture of that kochia growing in a field that had been sprayed, and everything else around it was dead, but that row where that kochia plant had rolled across that field and scattered its seeds, it left a trail of these plants. And we're going to see more. We see an awful lot of that. We even see that in our own health. People don't take all of their pills or something a doctor gives them, and their this germ, whatever it is, becomes resistant. And I know, the hospitals are really concerned about this thing. So that's what I see in farming. I don't see a great change in no-till planting. I think is going to be or no-till farming is going to be more and more forced on us by expenses. This year, do I want to work this ground down here and go through the expense of diesel, $3 and something a gallon, or do I want to just hire somebody to come in and plant it with no-till and then come in and spray it? And we've got some noxious weeds on it, so spraying will be an advantage to that point. So we're about convinced that we'll get somebody come in and no-till it, and then go in and spray it. You save moisture, you save soil. I know this winter, I'm sure you've seen it, the land blowing around different places. Well, we sat here and didn't have to worry about it because our stubble was on the ground. And down east here, we've seen where you couldn't see clear to the river because of the dust. So I think no-till is going to become more and more. Other than that, personally, the technology I'm not using, other than just those basic things, but I'm not using any. I can't. If I put on, get my soil test, it calls for 40 pounds of nitrogen, the whole field gets 40 pounds of nitrogen, whether it needs it or not. You know, that's the way that I'm farming now, and I probably will continue because I'm 81. We'll be 81 in June. And I've had several people want to rent the farm. I told Marilyn, hey, this is our first year out of debt. Let's do something. Maybe we can make a living and do something.
Any chance that a kid will come back?
No.
So you will.
Maybe our daughter's husband, Jeff Hahn, may want it, but that's 26 miles from here, and you know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But several of the neighbors, of course, the neighbors,
yeah.
Every neighbor, even when we were looking for land, if neighbor land was the best. We are farming some right north of Kinsley. Mrs. Lucille Georges, she's dead. She died this last year. But we had her option one time, and I was helping Jerry Allison do some work for her, and she told me that the guy that was farming, taking care of their land, was quitting. So I asked her about Mrs. George, and she told me who she was and where she lived, and I started home, and I'm going back and talk to her. Well, she said, I'm looking for that guy around Offerly that does auctions. I said, well, that's me. And so we had her auction, and then I asked her, I said, if there's anybody farming your land? She said, no. I said, you know, God must have sent you here, because that's been bothering me. And I couldn't believe it, with people all around the country ready to grab any land that's available. So we've been farming out for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years at least. And now her daughter, Diane Brown, is in Wichita. We're farming through her. So that was an addition to our farm. And a low light, I guess, in our life. In the mid-80s, we had to go take out bankruptcy. And that's...
A lot that did.
What?
There was a lot of people that did.
Yeah,
What, crop failure weather-wise, or...?
It was a lender. We had Farmers Home, and they were so adamant that we were going to give them this ground that to settle up with them, and then we could farm it and buy it back if we wanted it. And that's when we sold a quarter down south where we had the circle, and paid them off, got them out of it. And no, we didn't completely pay them off. We got them off our back. But about 5 years ago, I talked to Mike Hitz at the Ford County State Bank, and I said, can you help us on this? And because Farmers Home takes all your land. If you get a loan from them, they want all your land in that loan. And he said, we'll take, and they took the four lots across the north side. This is a correction line quarter, so instead of being four quarters, we're living on the south half of the north half, which is 180, which is a quarter, but it's a long one. The two right south of us are regular quarters, but there are four lots along the north side of it that have about 70 some acres in each lot. So we'll take those four lots, and they reduced the interest by half, and we paid them off.
That's just great.
Yeah. We got through all that, and the sad part about bankruptcy is you send your money to the referee, whatever they call him. He gets 10% right off the top, and then they pay the bills. Well, 10% of $13,000 will pay a lot towards whatever else. I mean, he's going to put it in a loan. It sure reduces. So that was it. And other than that, I don't know. Of course, our kids marry, our grandkids. Those are all important times in our life. But just these few personal things that stick out to you.